Otero out of Iowa. I'm Senior Analyst Foreign Policy in Focus, Ian Williams out of New York. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on this debate. I'm Marzi Hashemi. Bye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Inna رَبَّكُمُ اللَّهُ الَّذِي خَلَقَ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضَ فِي سِتَّةِ أَيَّامٍ خَلَقَ السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش يغشي الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا ربكم تضرعا وخفية ادعوا ربكم تضرعا وخفية إنه لا يحب المعتدين. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely, your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in six periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly, and He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely, His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely, He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran blames Israel for the Sunday terrorist act at the Natanz nuclear facility. It says it reserves the right to take revenge. And the U.S. police use force to disperse a protest held in Minneapolis after a white police officer shoots dead a 20-year-old African-American man. The number of coronavirus cases in Germany passes 3 million. The European country is struggling to contain a third wave of the pandemic. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behzad Shafiq. Good to have you with us. Now, top story, we have comments by Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif accusing Israel for the recent incident at Iran's Natanz nuclear facility, pledging that Tehran will take revenge. Zarif was cited by media saying that Israeli regime's officials have publicly announced that they will not let any progress in the process of removing the anti-Iran sanctions. He said Israelis think this way they can revenge the success made in recent talks aimed at reviving the Iran nuclear deal. However, Zarif stressed that Iran won't let this happen and will respond with further nuclear achievements. Zarif noted that the Natanz site will be equipped with more advanced centrifuges that have more enrichment capacity. He said the incident has also given Iran the upper hand in the talks. Meantime, the Iranian Foreign Ministry has slammed the latest Israeli sabotage act at the country's Natanz uranium enrichment facility, calling it an act of nuclear terrorism.
What happened in Natanz was a bold act of nuclear terrorism on Iranian soil. There has been no casualty or contamination reported, but it could very much resulted in a catastrophic situation. So it can be considered under the category of crimes against humanity, which the Israeli regime has been doing that for many years now.
Khatibzadeh says Iran reserves all rights to respond in kind under Article 51 of the UN Charter. The spokesman noted that Tehran has started communications with international authorities in this connection. Khatibzadeh stressed that the incident at Natanz won't slow down Iran's nuclear program. It will instead speed up the country's nuclear achievement. He said that the centrifuges damaged in the incident were the IR-1 type, and they will be replaced with the most advanced centrifuges that Iran has developed. Tim Anderson, the director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, says that the sabotage at Natanz is consistent with Tel Aviv's campaign against Iran's nuclear program.
The sabotage certainly seems consistent with the campaign that Israel has been carrying on about, but we don't have any details on the scale of the sabotage or to what extent it's actually affected electricity supplies, for example. With that limited information, I think it's right that people are informed about this and that Iran does reserve its rights, but on the other hand, there's also the some value in discipline and restraint in these circumstances, because it may be that the Israelis are probing, are trying to provoke something at a time when they fear that the Biden administration might be trying to de-escalate their relations with Iran. In some respects, it's a sign of desperation on the part of Israel, and they always risk overplaying their hand in these circumstances. You know, they count on the U.S. backing them up. I don't really think, as I said, that the JCPOA will be resuscitated, because I don't think the Biden administration is capable of doing that. But I think they do want to somehow find some sort of living together arrangement, some sort of compromise where they save some sort of face and de-escalate. I think the Washington probably wants to de-escalate in some way that leaves it claiming that it has some sort of moral victory there. So they probably don't appreciate all of the provocations of Israel at this stage.
U.S. police have clashed with protesters who gathered in the city of Minneapolis to condemn the police killing of yet another African-American man. Police used tear gas and rubber bullets to disperse the crowd. Demonstrators gathered outside the police headquarters holding Black Lives Matter banners and signs calling for justice. They later knocked off a road despite heavy police presence in the area. 20-year-old Donta Wright was killed after officers attempted to take him into custody for traffic violation on Sunday. He tried to get back into his vehicle when the deadly encounter happened. The Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension has launched an investigation into the shooting. The governor of the U.S. state of Virginia has vowed a thorough probe into an incident where two police officers assaulted a Black Army lieutenant. In a statement, Ralph Norham called the incident disturbing, promising an independent investigation into the matter. This after Lieutenant Kara Nazario filed charges against the officers, is that they pointed their guns and threatened to murder him. The suit says that Nazario, a man of Latino and Black ethnicity, had his hands up, showed no resistance, but he was pepper sprayed and violently knocked to the ground before being detained. The incident was captured on police body cameras as well as Nazario's cell phone. The federal court has investigated a case at a time of heightened awareness over police brutality and racial injustice. The retired Chief Deputy U.S. Marshal Matthew Fox says that the case of Nazario is another instance of a long pattern of police discrimination against Blacks in the U.S.
Well, you know, again, what we have here is a long pattern of where law enforcement has treated people of color differently. I've worked in law enforcement for 30 years. I've won a major lawsuit for race discrimination within my department. I've seen it. I've looked at situations all across the country where I can see these incidents occur. And we've got this sort of culture in place where there's two standards of how we do our duty.
Moving on, the number of confirmed coronavirus cases in Germany has surpassed the grim milestone of 3 million. A tally by the Robert Koch Institute for Disease Prevention and Control says that more than 13,000 additional infections were also reported. Nearly 100 more people also died of the coronavirus in the past day, and that brings Germany's COVID death toll to around 78,500. Germany is one of the world's worst hit countries by the pandemic. Chancellor Angela Merkel now planning to take control from federal states to impose restrictions on regions with high numbers of new infections. India has overtaken Brazil to become the second most affected country in terms of COVID cases in the world. The Indian Health Minister reported 169,000 new infections in one day. And that brings the tally to more than 13.5 million, surpassing Brazil's 13.4 million cases. India has also registered 900 new deaths, pushing the death toll to more than 170,000. The government blames the resurgence mainly on crowding and people's reluctance to wear masks. The United States is still the world's worst-hit nation, more than 31 million cases and 562,000 deaths. Rohingya refugees in India are more terrified, and that after the country's top court rejected a plea to stop the community from being deported to Myanmar. Munawar Zaman reports the court ruling has paved the way for India to deport the destitute community in due course.
It was an utter shock for the destitute Rohingya community in India after the country's Supreme Court rejected the petition seeking halt on the deportation process. The court in its ruling said the deportation process could go ahead as long as the government follows due process. Now more panic has gripped the community as their last hope seems lost. Experts say the Supreme Court ruling will give a sense of relief to the community for a while from being deported instantly. They, however, believe the ruling doesn't stop the detention process. Rather, it gives government more freedom to act swiftly. Legal experts are shocked about the judgment, saying the country has welcomed refugees from several countries since decades, but adopted a hostile approach towards Rohingya in particular. India has no legislation on the refugees, and it considers Rohingya as illegal immigrants and a threat to national security.
They can be deported in accordance with the law. Now, which law? Law, according to the government, means the Foreigners Act. Now, Foreigners Act doesn't deal with refugees. Refugees are a different category of people. We had argued that even non-citizens, even refugees, have Article 21 rights, the right to life.
In recent weeks, dozens or more refugees were detained from New Delhi. The police maintains they have orders from higher authorities to carry detention process. Now grief has befallen the destitute community. Rights activists say treating these refugees differently is a blow on India's ethos of Vasudeva Kutumbakam, which means the world is one family.
Why is it not our concern if there are refugees coming from there? It's not just the refugee law. There are so many laws dealing with the rights of children, the Human Rights Convention, the Civil and Political Rights Convention. They all talk about the principle of non-refoulement, which means that you cannot send somebody to a country or outside your territory where there will be danger to his life or limb.
Anti-Rohingya sentiments have risen since the emergence of Hindu nationalist government of BJP in 2014. Since then, many anti-Rohingya campaigns and Hindu groups have been demanding their expulsion. Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
Conservative candidate Guillermo Lasso wins Ecuador's presidential runoff. His socialist rival Andres Arauz has conceded defeat. Lasso had a 5% lead over Arauz with more than 93% of the votes counted. Arauz, who topped the first round with almost 33% of the votes, said that he had expected to win. Now, the election was held as the Andean country is facing one of its worst economic downturns caused by a raging COVID pandemic. The Peruvian presidential race is heading for a runoff, as exit polls indicate no single candidate expected to garner the required 51% ballot margin. Polls show far-left labor unionist Pedro Castillo is leading with 16%, but is still far short to avoid a runoff scheduled for June 6th. Conservative Keiko Fujimori and liberal economist Hernando de Soto are in the second place. Some 25 million Peruvians were eligible to cast their ballots for 18 candidates vying for the top executive post. The voting is mandatory in the country, and the government imposed a $25 fine for those failing to cast their ballots. A authorities prolonged the voting hours to prevent massing due to the pandemic. The coronavirus has infected 1.6 million people and killed 55,000 in that country. It's time now for the news review section. Do stay with us. The British Broadcasting Corporation has been flooded with complaints over its wall-to-wall coverage of the death of Prince Philip. Many people flocked to the BBC website to file complaints over the amount of coverage dedicated to the death of the 99-year-old prince. The corporation opened a dedicated complaints form on its website to deal with a high volume of comments. The BBC scrapped many programs and almost the entire range of its radio and television services following Philip's death. Viewing figures show that many BBC channels have lost audience. Some Twitter users criticized the company for trying to enforce a mood of national mourning, likening the channel to Soviet-style state broadcasters pumping out propaganda. Some others, however, said that it was being unfairly attacked for covering a major news story. Let's not get some insight on this. So joining me will be our own Amina Taylor in our London bureau, and also we'll have John White, writer and political analyst, who's joining us out of Edinburgh. Good to have you both. Amina, as you just heard, and I'm definitely know you have it, you have the pulse of news there. This has received some pretty mixed reactions. Tell us more about this.
Well, good morning from the British capital. I mean, it was not unexpected, let's be honest. There is some form here from the state broadcaster to really try and, shall I say, point us in the direction of our feelings and what we're supposed to be thinking at this time. So instead of, you know, a 99-year-old man who's lived a full life propped up by taxpayers' money here after having lived a pretty decent life in Greece, where he was a member of the royal family there, instead of us thinking on a personal note, his spouse, the monarch here, has lost her consort after 73 years, and to let that be a kind of private moment, instead there has been this wall-to-wall coverage. And there is a sense here that if you are not publicly grieving in some way, you're not seen to be attaching yourself to this emotion that's being, in some case, implanted from without, then there is a sense that you're being somehow unpatriotic or you're not being loyal enough. And I give you just one very brief example of this.
Sure.
The sportsman Lewis Hamilton, who was knighted by the Queen a year or two ago, he had the audacity on his own page to put a tribute out to a rap artist who had also passed on the same day. And I scroll through, I think, hundreds of messages saying, how ungrateful, can't you show some respect for a man who's died and done so much for this country? So this idea of manufacturing consent seems to be working in some cases, because dare you put your head above the parapet and go, you know, it's a tragedy, but we don't need to have wall-to-wall coverage. I think you'll see publicly what the response is from that.
Okay. Now, from Edinburgh, let's bring in John White. John, how do you look at this story, and tell us what you think of the way BBC performed regarding its coverage of that story?
An absolute spectacle of the absurd. Less a nation in mourning, this has been a festival of ruling establishment propaganda. And Amina touched on something very important when she mentioned the Lewis Hamilton example, because despite the BBC still thinking that we live in the 1950s when the country was almost entirely white, Britain today is a multi-ethnic, multi-religious, multicultural society, and there is not one British identity. And the hegemonic British identity, which has been supported by the BBC in its veneration of this 99-year-old man who never knew a second without privilege in his life, just shows that they are stuck in the 1950s with their conception of a British identity rooted in veneration to the royals and to the aristocracy. So this is an exercise in semi-feudalism. It's ruling class propaganda, and I'm very comforted by the amount of dissent that has been unleashed in response to this wall-to-wall, gushing, mawkish coverage of a man who was an absolute racist. And the way that they've tried to cover up his racism by using euphemistic terms such as he was an icebreaker, he spoke plainly, you know, he could have gaffes. The man was a racist, and he's part of a racist institution. On a human level, of course, you never glory in anyone's death, but it's the institution, it's poisoned British culture, and it's poisoned British society. The amount of bandwidth, has been expended on this man's death, the money that will be expended on his funeral, and when, at a time when every few days a homeless person dies in the UK. It's a disgrace.
And John, doesn't it also show how polarized British society is, you know, given the fact that some people were against this and they opposed this the way that that what you call also as rightly as wall-to-wall coverage of BBC. And also there were some others who were against it. They say, no, this is a major enough story for that.
Well, yes. I mean, obviously Brexit plays into this division across the country's regions and constituent nations. You know, we're seeing the events spill over in Belfast vis-a-vis Brexit, the fruits of Brexit, but going deeper than that, the history of British colonialism there with partition, and the country's never been more polarised, and what the ruling elite are definitely trying to do is to cover up the sinking ship that is the UK with this mythological treatment of British history and British establishment figures such as Prince Philip. This has not been an exercise in news or serious analysis of man's life, it's been an exercise in hagiography.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments. So we had Amina Taylor in London and also John White, writer and political analyst in Edinburgh, with their comments. And that's it for this news review. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead,
such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him. I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need, which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
The first spring donor retreat after a defeat for a political party is typically a moment of reflection and renewal as officials chart a new direction forward. But with former President Donald J. Trump determined to keep his grip on the Republican Party and the party's base as adhered to him as ever, the coming together of the Republican National Committee's top donors in South Florida this weekend is less a moment of reset and more a reminder of the continuing tensions and schisms roiling the GOP. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Shane Goldmacher, Maggie Haberman, and Jonathan Martin. The piece is titled A Tremendous Complication: GOP Dances Around Trump's Lingering Presence. First spring donor retreat after a defeat for a political party is typically a moment of reflection and renewal as officials chart a new direction forward. But with former President Donald J. Trump determined to keep his grip on the Republican Party and the party's base as adhered to him as ever, the coming together of the Republican National Committee's top donors in South Florida this weekend is less a moment of reset and more a reminder of the continuing tensions and schisms roiling the GOP. The same former president who last month sent the Republican National Committee a cease and desist letter demanding they stop using his likeness to raise money will on Saturday evening serve as the party's fundraising headliner. A tremendous complication was how Fred Zeidman, a veteran Republican fundraiser in Texas, described Donald Trump's lingering presence on the political scene. The delicate dance between Mr. Trump and the Republican Party after losing the House, the Senate, and the White House on his watch will manifest in some actual shuttle bus diplomacy on Saturday, as the party's top donors attend a series of receptions and panels at the Four Seasons Resort before traveling to Mar-a-Lago, the former president's private club, to hear Donald Trump speak. Donald Trump's insistence on leading the Republican Party affects every member, Mr. Zeidman said, as lawmakers and would-be elected officials jockey for a Trump endorsement that was as powerful in a Republican primary as it could be problematic in a general election. He's already proven that he wants to have a major say or keep control of the party, and he's already shown every sign that he's going to primary everybody that has not been supportive of him, Mr. Zeidman said. He complicates everything so much. Among other things, Donald Trump is considering running again in 2024. Though few of his allies believe he will follow through, his presence could have a chilling effect on other potential candidates. The party is still very much revolving around Donald Trump, said Andrea Katsmatidis, a chairwoman of the Manhattan Republican Party and a donor who will be at the retreat. He was the one who very much revived the party when we weren't winning. Also inescapable is the fact that Donald Trump has quickly built a political war chest that rivals that of the Republican National Committee. An advisor to Donald Trump said he currently had about $85 million on hand, compared with nearly $84 million for the Republican National Committee. Send your donation to Save America PAC, Donald Trump urged supporters last month, not to RINOs, the derisive acronym for Republicans in name only. Mr. Trump has appeared as passionate about punishing Republicans who crossed him, especially those who supported his second impeachment, as he has about taking back the House and the Senate in 2022. For party officials, the goal is keeping the energy that has propelled Donald Trump to success inside the Republican tent, while not entirely allowing the former president to dominate it. Ronna McDaniel, the Republican National Committee chairwoman, whom Donald Trump supported for a second term, has vowed to remain neutral in a potential 2024 primary should Donald Trump run again. It is a difficult balancing act, said Bill Palatucci, a Republican National Committee man from New Jersey who has been critical of Donald Trump. The president certainly has devoted followers, Mr. Palatucci said, but he also more than offended a lot of people with his conduct since the November election, which culminated in his helping to incite a riot on 6th of January. Several Republicans who are considered likely to run for president in 2024, including Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida, and Governor Kristi Noem of South Dakota, were scheduled to speak to the Republican National Committee's donors at the Four Seasons. Mike Pompeo, the former Secretary of State and CIA director who served under Donald Trump, has been scheduled to speak on Friday but did not attend the gathering. Notably absent are two leading Republican figures who also skipped the last big Republican gathering, the Conservative Political Action Conference that Donald Trump attended. Former Vice President Mike Pence, who's starting his own political advocacy group, and Nikki Haley, the former United Nations ambassador. Some donors are hoping to quickly move past Mr. Trump, but they are also focused on the current Oval Office occupant. It is very important the Republican Party puts Donald Trump as far into the past as possible, said William Obendorf, an investor in California who has given millions to GOP candidates but fiercely opposes the former President Donald Trump. However, if Joe Biden does not ensure that major pieces of legislation have bipartisan support, it is he who will bear more responsibility than any group of Republican donors ever could for resurrecting Mr. Trump's political future and fortunes, he added. Among donors, the jockeying for favor and financing extends beyond Donald Trump and the Republican National Committee. On Thursday and Friday, a separate but overlapping gathering for Republican contributors was held at Donald Trump's private club. An investors' meeting of the Conservative Partnership Institute, CPI, a non-profit organization. Mark Meadows, who served as Donald Trump's chief of staff, is now a senior advisor for the group. And Caroline Wren, who used to fundraise for the former president, is raising money for it. Donors are being pitched for on a dizzying array of Trump-adjacent projects, including Mike Pence's group and new entities being started by Ben Carson, Donald Trump's former housing secretary, Stephen Miller, his former White House advisor, and Russell Vought, the former director of the Office of Management and Budget, OMB. Corey Lewandowski, Donald Trump's first campaign manager in 2016, is said to be involved with efforts to start a Trump-aligned super PAC as well.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello, welcome to Economic Divide with me, Kavit Ahlai. In this week's episode, we will look at the Syrian war, or the war on Syria, should I say, which turned 10, a milestone to be ashamed of. I mean, what can be said about the Syrian war that has not been said already? Well, that is exactly the point. It needs to remain in the headlines. Now, before the war on Syria broke out, Syria had two main products for revenues, namely agriculture and oil. Together, they accounted for about one-half of the country's GDP. Agriculture, for instance, accounted for about 26% of the GDP and employed 25% of the total labor force. Well, the sanctions and destruction have devastated Syria's economy. For example, the total economic loss from the Syrian civil war for the year 2015 was $237 billion. Now, it could have reached $400 billion for the year 2020, as far as the records go. Well, the Syrian opposition's capture cost the government a further $507 million a year because of the revenue loss at the border crossing, Nasib being the biggest one. In this program, we will not only try to cover the economic consequences of this war, but we will also give a touch of the humanitarian aspect, which is truly heartbreaking. Well, the first report will take a look at the timeline of this war, which has just marked its 10-year anniversary.
The Syrian tragedy will go down as one of the darkest chapters in recent history. The Syrian people are among the greatest victims of this century.
It started out with small protests. The Syrian government moved in to quell them. President Assad still held massive popularity. Protests got out of hand and soon swept the nation like homes. Terrorists filled the vacuum, but so did Russia, to save Syria. The sign says it all. More and more joined the war, like these fighters calling themselves the Shield of Aleppo. Neighborhoods fell to the terrorists. Religious monuments like the famous Umayyad Mosque not spared. Syrian troops regaining territory. Alliances had shifted, some pro-government, others against. But Daesh persisted, holding on to the stronghold in Raqqa.
And I'm back because of your arrogant foreign policy towards the Islamic State.
Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is dead.
Assad and Russian forces were falsely accused of killing civilians. Yet the U.S. and its allies were fueling the war. The cry of pain. The moment after a bombing. The devastation afterwards.
Joining me in the studio is Omar Waqaf. He's the founder and director of Knossos. His Twitter address, @TheKnossosView. It's an organization expressing stakeholder opinion in Syria and the Middle East. He's been a major contributor to the war in Syria, and he has appeared on numerous media outlets to give a realistic view of what is happening in that country. Omar Waqaf, welcome to the program. Taking a look at what has happened, this 10-year anniversary of this war, it's beyond imagination the devastation that this country has experienced. And it's going to be futile for me to have you engage in what has occurred, but I'd rather have you look at what, how things can be fixed, that is. I mean, Syria and Syrians, the path forward, how do you think that is achievable, do you think?
Well, I tell you what, you know, being a Syrian citizen and understanding things on the ground, the first key issue that should take place is that Syrian or Syrians agreeing that the objective of throwing out the government is not going to be realized. Once the majority of Syrians, even those who have been hopeful for the past 10 years for NATO to come, for, you know, whatever thing happens that could overthrow the current government, once they realize that this is not an achievable objective, because what we hear also is a lot of fanfare about UN Resolution 2254 and, you know, Constitutional Committee. And the way these things are viewed by this segment of Syrians is not about political, reconciliation or, you know, political realignment. It is actually being seen, or these are actually being seen, as tools to overthrow the current government. And they keep dreaming about, you know, Russia ordering Assad to go, Iran being bombed and withdrawing its troops, and, you know, having this catastrophical or apocalyptical sort of solutions. None of that is going to happen.
Okay, thank you, Omar Waqaf. We're going to have him back a little later on. Taking a look at now our next report, we know that the war has had an effect on the Syrians when it comes to their nutrition. Aside from poverty and unemployment, one of the outcomes is food insecurity. It's a consequence that is plaguing a large majority of the population there.
After a decade of conflict and displacement, Syrians are facing the worst humanitarian conditions. Millions have slid into hunger in the last year alone.
that's not all. The collapse of the Syrian pound, its impact on the price of basic commodities, the fallout from the financial crisis in Lebanon, as well as large-scale displacements, all to further exacerbate the situation. COVID-19 pandemic has made that situation worse. Some 4.5 million have sunk into hunger and food insecurity. The findings are shocking. A record 12.4 million Syrians, nearly 60% of the population, suffer from food insecurity and hunger today, double the number in the year 2018.
You have COVID, you have loss of the value of the currency itself, and then you have mass displacement. So when you put all of these things together, there is no surprise that we are seeing rising food insecurity, rising hunger, not only in the breadth, meaning lots and lots of people, but also in the depth.
The number of people who cannot survive without food assistance has doubled in 1 year, reaching 1.3 million people. Food prices have increased by more than 200% just in the last year. Some Syrians have not eaten meat and fruit for months due to the high prices.
Our next guest joining us in the studio is Derek Ford. He is a lecturer at DePauw University. Now, according to his bio, his research and teachings are situated what he calls the nexus of educational theory and contemporary politics. Derek, welcome. Russia, Iran, and Turkey have keen interest in a united Syria to prosper. But U.S. allies like Saudi Arabia, like Israel, well, they are destabilizing Syria. They're preventing economic advancement in that country. Israel bombing Syria routinely. Shouldn't this be addressed in order to eliminate this catastrophic economic devastation taking place there? Because no one is going to invest in a country that is being bombed or that is fueled with instability.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, President Joe Biden, in one of his first acts, even before he addressed the needs of the people in the United States, was to bomb Syria yet again and to claim self-defense. As if, you know, the U.S. has any right to claim self-defense in Syria, where they haven't been invited by the government, and they're there as an illegal occupying army, right, an illegal occupying force. And so they obviously give the green light to Israel for those bomb droppings, and I think that that's one of the main obstacles. That, you know, the war has to end, right? There has to come to an end. It has to come to an end. It's been going on too long. There's been way too much suffering. And the objectives that the U.S. and its allies set out to achieve haven't been attained, and they are, in fact, unattainable.
Well, what about these sanctions, such as the CSAR Act? That was like the final blow by the previous U.S. President Donald Trump before he left office. Not only do these sanctions, like the CSAR Act, worsen the existing humanitarian crisis there, well, it has deprived the Syrian people of their chance to rebuild their lives through their infrastructure rebuilding. I mean, is that the U.S. aim?
Yeah, that's definitely the case. And, you know, a Lancet Medical Journal article from July of last year, I believe, noted the sanctions' immense impact on Syria recovering from COVID-19. And so I think the fact that, you know, the blockades, the sanctions are aimed really at that tells you what they're really about, you know? I mean, for one, the sanctions are for government-controlled areas, right, which is just legitimate Syrian territory, where 70% of the people live. And so they've cost, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars. There's sort of runaway inflation. It's an annual, you know, it's at the highest annual inflation rate ever just because there's a scarcity of goods, scarcity of jobs, and so on and so forth. And so obviously it's part of the war, right? It's not a separate, it's a tactic in the war to try, despite 10 years of resistance and really victory, to overthrow the Syrian government.
Well, very well, thank you for that. We appreciate it. Derek Ford, lecturer at DePauw University, with his comments there. Okay, we're about to take a short break here on Economic Divide, but don't go anywhere as we have plenty more coming up, so stay right where you are. It's time now to take a look at our final report, which is really a close look at the CSAR Act. Now, the previous U.S. President Donald Trump and his team were responsible for executing it. They claimed that it would target the government only, but doesn't that mean Syrians would suffer? Some argue for and against it, but take it from us here in Iran. We know U.S.'s real intentions. After all, we have been the target of U.S. sanctions.
Today, we begin a sustained campaign of sanctions against the Assad regime under the Caesar Act, named after the brave photographer who 6 years ago brought the world documented proof of the Assad regime's brutality against fellow Syrians. These targeted designations seek to deny the regime revenue and support that it uses to wage war and to commit mass atrocities against the Syrian people. The Assad regime and those who support it have a simple choice. Take irreversible steps towards a lasting political solution to the Syrian conflict in line with UNSCR 2254 or face ever new tranches of crippling sanctions.
Time to bring back Amar Waqaf, founder and director of Gnosos, with the Twitter hashtag at the Gnosos View, an organization that expresses stakeholder opinion in Syria and the Middle East. Okay, Amar, welcome back. There never has been really an effort to bring down a government like in the case of Syria. So many foreign players, the U.S., Israel, Saudi Arabia, for example. What are the U.S. aims in this country? I mean, why has it spent all this energy on this war when it could have spent that energy maybe on finding a political solution, or better yet, to push an economic solution to heal the nation so that it can move forward?
Well, basically, the U.S. aim has been, since the very start of this crisis, is to effect and gain political, geopolitical influence in Syria. With the current Syrian government, the way it is aligned, either with Iran or Russia or whatever, basically anti-Israeli interest in the region, that was not going to happen. So the only way to do it is to bring it down. That's option number one, and bring another or a replacement government or a political body that could adhere to such interests, or B, force it to change its course of action, basically by starving its, to death. And this is what's happening, because the first objective didn't happen. They couldn't do it. There were enough Syrians whose interests really laid in keeping the government on its feet. They sent their children to military. They suffered a lot. And now they're suffering very much. So the next possible thing for the American policy is to force the current Syrian government to compromise with its needs in the region. What is really happening is that the Syrian people are really suffering. We need to understand also that the United States isn't only effecting sanctions that are suffocating Syria. They are also preventing Syrian people from benefiting from their own resources like wheat, water, electricity from the Euphrates, and most significantly oil. And now when Syrians need to import oil, their tankers are being targeted and everything. So all in all, there is a double action to suffocate the Syrian state, and this, my opinion, inadvertently is actually pushing Syria more towards the, strengthening the alliance with Iran and Russia.
All right,
and
very
China,
well.
Of course.
Great. Thank you so much for that. We appreciate Amar Waqaf, founder and director of Gnosos, there with his comments. Right now it's time to take a look at one of the worst affected and perhaps the most traumatized segments of the Syrian society, namely children. Hundreds and thousands of them have lost their parents to this war. One shocking figure: nearly 5 million children were born inside Syria over the past 10 years. But the following faces tell a story of pain and wounded hearts. in that section, we are going to take a look at Syria's war, but in numbers. We figured that's the best thing to do. 10 years of war, upending the lives of millions of Syrians, a natural outcome of this war. The economy, as a result, it has pummeled. And along with that key infrastructure, it has been ravished. Here are some of the numbers. First, the human cost, 450,000 dead. In terms of the people who have fled this war, 4.5 million. And the people who are missing, it is recorded to be roughly around 200,000 people. Next comes one of the darkest chapters of this war. Instances of chemical weapons usage. 38 have been recorded. And in one attack, only 1,400 were killed. The world blaming Assad, but it turned out that the terrorists had actually staged many of those attacks, if not all. Now the economy, ravaged to the tune of $1.2 trillion over the course of 10 years. $91.5 billion lost revenue from hydrocarbons, and 98% the devaluation of the Syrian pound to the dollar on the black market. In terms of food prices, 33 times higher across the country. Taking a look at the children who are facing hunger, 60% of the population of children. And in terms of poverty, you're looking at 2 million people. Now, our final look at the numbers comes to infrastructure. Energy grids in that country, 70% are out of order. Hospitals, only 58% are functional. And when it comes to schools, in terms of operational capability of them, 33% are in ruins, which leaves roughly about 67% that are working. When it comes to the war on Syria, it appears that it has faded from the headlines. I said that in the beginning of the program, but it shouldn't. For starters, Israel is bombing that country over and over again. Another country that is occupying it, namely the U.S., well, it's stealing its resources, namely oil, which the revenues could go to the desperate people of Syria. But there's another reason why Syria should not fade from the headlines. It should serve as a reminder that the U.S. push for regime changes and the redrawing of the map of West Asia or the Middle East has failed. Meanwhile, there's another path to changing the dynamics of the region, and that is economically. For where there's economic prosperity and trade between countries, there are less tensions and chances for war. That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. From Mikhail Tavai and the entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
In the limelight.
The former British ambassador to Bahrain, Peter Ford, said, "I can say from personal experience that the Persian Gulf rulers are very generous with the money of their citizens and are very ready to shower visiting British royals with very expensive gifts. It was one reason why the British royals were always super happy to visit Persian Gulf monarchies. They were guaranteed to receive expensive gifts like diamonds, racehorses, holidays on private islands, cars, and the British royals have a constant problem with money." We now present you an article written by staff writers of Iran's English-language TV channel Press TV. The piece is titled, "British Royals Lend Legitimacy to Tyrannical Arab Monarchies." Please stay with us for more of the Press TV article. A decade since widespread pro-democracy protests rocked the Arab world, Many of the autocrats in these countries still remain in power. The promises of reform turned out to be big lies, while torture and imprisonment of political dissidents and journalists persist to this day. While these kings, sheikhs, and emirs are ruling their people with a rod of iron, the British royal family seems to be more than willing to visit the Persian Gulf tyrannies, presumably giving them legitimacy and a pat on the back. A new research by Declassified UK has thrown into sharp relief the unconditional support the Persian Gulf autocrats have enjoyed over the past decade by the House of Windsor. According to the Daily Maverick, Britain's royal family has met members of autocratic West Asian monarchies nearly once a fortnight since the crackdown, adding up to over 200 meetings over the last decade. The former British ambassador to Bahrain, Peter Ford, wrote, "The main significance of these royal contacts is about legitimacy, because the British institution of the monarchy represents a purported form of international legitimacy. British royalty is supposedly respected. It has an enormously long history, and to be seen to be with and have the approval of the British monarchy is seen by outsiders as a form of legitimacy, of approval for the way you're running your own country. Prince Charles, expected to be the next British monarch, has had 95 encounters with the Arab monarchies since 2011, almost half of Prince Charles's meetings with Arab royalty. Prince Charles is followed by Prince Andrew with 70 encounters. Four of Andrew's meetings were with Sheikh Abdullah, the King of Bahrain's second son.